Picture a world drunk on its own success. The year is 1973, and humanity stands at the apex of industrial triumph. Skyscrapers pierce the clouds, assembly lines hum with mechanical precision, and economists proclaim the problem of production solved. Then an economist named E.F. Schumacher publishes a book with a heretical title, Small is Beautiful. Within months, the oil crisis hits, revealing the fragility of our resource-dependent civilization. Suddenly, his warning doesn't sound so crazy. What if our greatest achievements were actually leading us toward catastrophe? What if the very logic that built our modern world contained the seeds of its destruction? This wasn't just another economics book. It was a manifesto that would sell over 1 million copies, get translated into 27 languages, and earn recognition as one of the most influential works published since World War II. Leaders from Jimmy Carter to the Dalai Lama found wisdom in its pages. Why? Because Schumacher dared to question the unquestionable, our blind faith in growth, bigness, and technological domination. Modern civilization treats nature's million-year savings account as renewable income. Wealthy nations consume 14 times more fuel per capita than poor ones. Had 1970s growth patterns continued, world fuel consumption would have quadrupled by 2000, with rich countries, just 23% of the population, driving two-thirds of this increase. Beyond fossil fuels, we're depleting nature's tolerance for synthetic compounds against which evolution has no defense. These chemicals accumulate in soil, water, and bodies with consequences we're only beginning to understand. Why does a plastic toy command more value than clean air? Because one has a price while the other remains free until it's polluted. Economics has become our supreme arbiter, yet its judgments are dangerously fragmentary, considering only monetary profit while ignoring social, aesthetic, moral, and political dimensions. This calculus treats fundamentally different categories, oil reserves, forests, manufactured goods, healthcare, as equivalent based solely on price. A corporation might find it more economical to pollute a river and pay fines than properly dispose of waste. The Amazon's value as cleared farmland appears on balance sheets, while its crucial role in climate regulation remains economically invisible. Buddhist economics reframes work not as a necessary evil, but as essential to human flourishing through creativity, skill development, and meaningful contribution. While modern economics celebrates automation and treats labor as a cost to minimize, Buddhist economics asks why we'd eliminate activities that give life meaning. Local production for local needs forms another cornerstone, connecting nearby producers and consumers rather than shipping goods thousands of miles, reducing environmental impact while strengthening community bonds. Renewable resources are preferred over non-renewable ones, and living systems deserve reverence as complex wholes, not merely commodity sources. Unprecedented mobility has made social structures vulnerable. Lima, Peru exploded from 175,000 people in the 1920s to nearly 3 million by the early 1970s, with rural migrants arriving at 1,000 daily, overwhelming social systems. Small nations absorbed into larger economic unions see their capitals reduced to provincial cities and cultures marginalized. The critical insight: viability isn't about states, it's about people. Combining non-viable people into larger communities doesn't make them viable. We need production by the masses rather than mass production. Democracy and human dignity require small, comprehensible groups. Buddhist economics offers a middle way, balanced development integrating material well-being with spiritual growth, environmental preservation, and social harmony. Civilizations collapse not from depleted resources, but from exhausted human minds. When civilizations advance, we see simultaneous outbursts of daring and invention sustained through education. Yet modern education faces a profound crisis. Dominant ideas, evolution, competition, relativism, share a common reductionism, explaining higher phenomena as nothing but manifestations of the lower. humans become mere accidents, cultural achievements nothing but economic greed or sexual frustration. These ideas seep into young minds, making the world seem meaningless. Education cannot help us while denying deeper questions. Darwin himself lamented how his scientific mind atrophied his capacity for poetry and art, a loss of happiness, potentially injurious to intellect and moral character. True education produces whole persons connected to their basic convictions about life's meaning. To create such order, we must embrace different metaphysical ideas, recognizing hierarchical levels of being that make the world intelligible, acknowledging that we think in opposites, and distinguishing between convergent problems solvable by logic and divergent problems requiring higher forces like love and wisdom. Modern technology lacks self-limiting principles. Unlike nature, which knows when to stop growing, technology has no self-balancing mechanisms, triggering three crises: human revolt against suffocating patterns, environmental breakdown, and resource depletion. Rich countries are the world's problem children. The poor cannot adapt our technology without mass unemployment and social upheaval. We need technology with a human face, making hands and brains more productive rather than redundant. As Gandhi observed, the poor cannot be helped by mass production, only by production by the masses. Consider how differently you feel using a hand tool versus operating an automated machine. One engages creativity and skill, the other reduces you to a button pusher. Intermediate technology, superior to primitive methods but simpler than super technology, is decentralized, ecologically compatible, and serves humans rather than enslaving them. Hope rests on ordinary people supporting pioneering groups demonstrating viable alternatives. A rational economic system distinguishes between renewable and non-renewable resources, between production that enhances or degrades human dignity. Bhutan's Gross National Happiness Index and New Zealand's well-being budget demonstrate viable alternatives to GDP-focused models. Our economic thinking must address poverty, alienation, and spiritual emptiness through frameworks serving human flourishing, appropriate technology, meaningful work, and systems that preserve nature and community. The economics of permanence must become central. Nothing makes economic sense unless it can continue indefinitely. Small-scale operations cause less harm than large-scale ones. Work should be humanized, not abolished. Each person must first order their inner house, placing material things in their proper secondary position. The four cardinal virtues offer guidance: prudentia, clear-eyed objectivity; justitia, relating to truth; fortitudo, relating to goodness; and temperancia, knowing when enough is enough. Modern civilization measures everything by price and nothing by worth, forgetting that enough is good and more than enough is evil. We've built a system that ravishes nature and mutilates humanity, believing more wealth solves everything. This delusion now faces challenge from physical reality: climate chaos, resource exhaustion, and social breakdown. We cannot control these forces by mobilizing more resources. What's needed is a fundamental revision of ends, developing a lifestyle where material things occupy their proper secondary place. When people ask what they can actually do, the answer is both simple and challenging. Put your own inner house in order first. Perhaps the most revolutionary act in our time is insisting that enough is enough, that quality matters more than quantity, and that human scale is the only scale at which we can truly flourish. Your choice isn't between progress and regression, it's between wisdom and destruction. Choose wisely.